Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Becky Hill, and welcome to my podcast about dance music and its culture, where I'll be talking to hand-picked dance music legends to discuss their music, their careers, and their influence on the scene. I've asked my guests to bring along three tracks that mean or say something to them. It could be an artist that's influenced them, a beat that has changed them, or a record that reminds them of a certain place or a certain time. And I've brought my own track that defines why they're my guest. This time, I'm talking with Pete Tong, a true industry legend, head of his own record label, international club DJ, Radio 1 presenter, record producer, the list goes on. Thank you so much for doing this, by the way, because I know how manic it's been for you over the last 2 weeks because I've been with you.
Exactly.
With the whole Ibiza Classics tour. And I think it's really important. The reason why I've wanted to speak to you is because of this, because of the whole Ibiza Classics tour. And it's, what, the fourth year now?
Yeah.
And I remember going to see the show. The first show right. at the O2 and being slightly dazed and in my own world, let's say, I remember saying to the people I was with, I need to be doing that show.
Right.
And I won't stop until I'm doing that show. And he was like, you will be next year.
Right.
And lo and behold, we were. Mainly because I think I told my management to beg you for a slot on that show. So... But before we get into this, I think...
Well, happy we did.
Yeah, me too.
Now you're not leaving.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to buy a triangle for next
exactly,
year.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my part. So I think before I get on to... I mean, I have so many questions for you. But before that, I think... Can you tell me what initially started to make you fall in love with DJing when you were a kid?
I just always wanted to be involved in music. I love music. I started banging things when I was a kid, so I'm told by my parents. They got me a drum kit super young, and then at school I was in a band, bad heavy metal band. And I used to sit in my front room just listening to kind of like T-Rex and Deep Purple and like old rock bands, The Who. And then at a school disco one year, I saw a DJ for the first time in my life, like literally two turntables and an old amplifier stuck in between playing somebody else's music, and it just made a lot more of a better noise kind of thing. And it was an instant kind of love affair with the idea of playing other people's music to people.
Was it always dance music you wanted to do?
Well, no, at the beginning, like super early, it was like the pop music of the day, because I was doing kind of school, I did literally took over the school disco. And then I gravitated quite quickly into things that were kind of funky or danceable.
Yeah.
So, pre-disco, and just, dance records back in the day. So it was like KC and the Sunshine Band. My dad was quite a big record buyer. So he would, occasionally we'd get these American kind of funk records and stuff like that.
Right.
So it was like anything you could dance to. So, and hence... then getting into James Brown and Parliament and Funkadelic and stuff like that. So.
Do you still play those records now?
Very, very rarely. At some kind of exceptional circumstance. Probably last time I played a record like that was I did a thing with I'm just trying to think. It was with Rob the Bank actually on a beach in Ibiza, probably about 15-20 years ago, where we just decided to play a 7-inch set. So I had to bring 7 inches out. So
wow.
But I mean, I got asked to do a vinyl set this year, and I did it in Miami. And it was my vinyl had been in storage for a long, long time, like years and years and years. It was the collection was too big to ever get out in my house, and it was just too heavy. So it had been locked up in storage, and for years I thought I should have sold some of it or whatever, but I kept it. And then when we went to kind of unpack it and start to organize it, because I knew this vinyl set was coming up, I found out that one of the units, the records in, got flooded, and I lost a lot of the 7 inches actually.
Oh no!
So I got they're now in Bethnal Green in a one of these units, like a shipping container, and it's all got shelves inside. I'm not telling anyone where it is. Bethnal Green, and near Dizzy Rascal's house. So
work it out from there.
Yeah. But yeah, so I've got it all racked out again. I was able to do this vinyl set, and it was a lot of fun. So it was going back kind of physical records and stuff like that.
Yeah. Did your dad take you record shopping a lot then? Was it your dad?
No, not really. I mean, only into there was a local record store in Gravesend that was pretty cool, and they did the crowd that I grew up around were quite savvy to you call it underground music of the day. So it was like funk and soul records, jazz funk records, reggae records. Mm. And they would go up to London and come back down with different records and stuff like that. And this record shop tried to get in on that and be part of that and stock a certain, try to specialise in a certain type of music. And I got a part-time job in there, actually, because I just loved... the idea of in the old days of a record store, the sleeve would sit out in the shop and the record would be filed on a shelf in a container a sleeve, another sleeve. And then if someone wanted to buy the record, they'd bring the sleeve to the counter, the till, and then you'd have to go and get the record and put it in the thing. It was like antiquated. But that's what you had to do. And I loved the whole process of kind of cataloguing records, and I was a train spotter.
Yeah, I feel like it was a lot more special, I suppose, back in the day.
Well, I think just seeking out records, it was a mission. Yeah. It was an absolute mission. And it was the... It was the making of you as a DJ in terms of how you the kind of records you found and the records you bought, and that told everything about you. Was how back in the day we'd get records and cover up the labels, and put like I'd literally sit on my kitchen table and cut out a white circle and then physically stick it on top of the label and then write something different on it. So that obviously when people came to the DJ booth and they asked what the record is, they couldn't find out what it was.
Really?
So we did all of that.
How sneaky.
Yeah.
Was that how competitive it was back in the day then?
Super competitive in the kind of old soul and jazz funk scene, yeah.
Right.
And then, it was definitely a mission to get records. It was, it was mail order. You used to get these magazines that used to write about the music, and then record shops in the back would have... these really train spottery like ads that was just like endless type of like all these different titles. So then you'd have to like send off a check to the record shop, and get it mailed to you. So it was
check, man.
And then, or you'd have to go up, and then eventually I started going up to London and visiting all the hot record shops. And then you have to build your reputation with the person behind the counter that you become the one that they want us, they didn't want to just sell the records to anyone. So, if you were just Joe,
no way,
blogs off the street, if they only had 5 copies of something, then you weren't going to get one of those.
Right.
You had to be someone to get one. So I had to work my way up through all of the hierarchy of that. And there was 2 shops in particular that I got. There was Groove Records, which is around the corner from here, in Greek Street, long gone. And then there was one in Holborn called City Sounds on Proctor Street. And I got to the top of the tree of both of those stores. And at City Sounds, I would literally be there when the boxes came in from America. And then open up the boxes. And they would almost give me the records to check and find out which were the hot ones were. And so I got right to the top of the front of the process.
How long did that take you, do you reckon?
A few years to get to that, yeah.
And what did that entail then? Did that entail going around to the clubs in the local area and kind of making your name out in the on the dance floor and then being able to return to the record shops?
It was kind of working my way into a gang. There was a kind of a soul mafia back in the day that was a group of DJs that were kind of the biggest DJs on the scene. And it all, you know, the specialist soul scene was in London, but it was also in all the home counties. You're talking about the kind of late 70s going into the early 80s.
Yeah.
And the way I was the kind of young whippersnapper, like I was probably 10 years younger maybe than all these guys, maybe a bit more with a couple of them. And I just started running clubs in Kent and then booking them to come and play for me. And then eventually they got to know me, and then I started to get booked to play with them at their clubs in, you know, Essex or London or whatever. And I built my way into the scene like that. And then they used to hold these all-dayers and like these special one-off events at kind of bank holidays and Christmas or whatever. And I started to appear on the bill of those parties. So yeah, work my way up. And then
Work
my way into it.
Do you think it was more of a thing of like you kind of knew these guys, but you were holding your own parties?
Yeah.
And totally, wanted to book them for your own parties. And then it was a kind of respect thing of like, oh, here's Pete. He's not only DJing, but he's booking his own parties.
Yeah, back in the day, it was very much about, as much as about the music you played, it was about, having something going on. So being entrepreneurial enough. What made you hot is if you had a hot club or a hot club night or a crowd that went with you. So I was building that up big time in Kent.
Yeah. No way.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about your track that you've chosen, One Nation Under a Groove by Funkadelic, 1978. I'm guessing this was kind of like the anthem of your DJ sets then back in...
It was in the first phase of me making my name as a DJ. It was like the kind of ultimate funk party record. It was a brilliant record. It's Bootsy Collins. He was part of Parliament, but he broke off and did his own thing as Funkadelic. And it's kind of timeless. I mean, it's been sampled a million times and it's like had a profound influence on, you know, hip-hop and urban music and people like Pharrell and... you know, all the greats, basically. Mm. And it's just still sounds as good today. And it's probably as difficult to probably figure out how it actually got made as well. But yeah, brilliant piece of music, One Nation Under a Groove, and it's still with a great message.
Well, here it is.
Ready or not, here we come. Getting down on the one which we believe.
From Kent to London?
Well, I was still commuting from Kent in my 20s.
Right.
So I just used to drive up and down. You know, I had a residency in Baker Street, a place called the Barracuda Club in the early 80s, and then started appearing more as a DJ in other clubs around London. But I was always going backwards and forwards.
And how did that happen? Was that through the little collective you'd gotten into?
Yeah, I mean, things started to change in the 80s. That, you know, the soul scene was very predicated around the past and things that were rare and old. So we were, you know, some of the records we were playing were current, but some of the records we were playing were like, might have been 5-10 years old.
Right.
And it was all about their rarity and like digging deep and finding them. And then really when kind of electro and like hip hop started to break through at the beginning of the 80s, I was always a progressive, you know, I was always curious about the next big thing. I always wanted to go forward. As much as I had fun going backwards, for me, I was excited about the new sounds, new technology, you know, new trends. I was a journalist as well for a magazine, so I was always writing about like what was next and what was new. And it was a natural thing for me that like hip hop from literally, you know, Grandmaster Flash, The Message, you know, Sugar Hill Gang into the early days of Def Jam.
Right.
This was like mind blowing. And it caused a bit of a division because I would be playing, you know, Rock the Bells by LL Cool J or something like that. And the old soul scene kind of rulers, you know, the old grandfathers of the scene were like, well, you know, what the fuck are you doing? You can't play that. You can't play that. So it started to cause a bit of a division. I started to kind of drift away from them and started to do more of my own thing, and kind of start to join the dots up with the next, you know, generation and the next kind of gang that I would hang with. So the early part of the 80s was all about that. And I got a job in a record company in 1983 called London Records, just as it was starting. And they were always very, I mean, one of the first, the day I went to work, they were number one in the charts with Candy Girl by New Edition. And they'd already put out Walking on Sunshine by Rocker's Revenge.
Big tune.
And the two guys that ran it were like infatuated by dance music and reggae. One of them was Trinidadian, sort of half Trinidadian. So, and Roger Ames is still around today in the background at Black Butter, actually.
Oh, really?
So, they had a big influence on me. And I started like signing dance records. So I signed Run DMC back in the day, Salt and Pepper, and kind of made my name doing that as an A&R guy. And then
did you sign Goldie?
Yeah, yeah, that came later.
That must have been a bit. Yeah, a bit of
stories
madness
about that.
Yeah.
But then we started. Then dance music really started to explode in the mid '80s, and just as house music was starting to come through, the first few house records I ever signed from Chicago were we put out on London Records, and we did a compilation called The House Sound of Chicago Volume 1, and all the seminal dance records from house records at that time went on that album, like Marshall Jefferson, Move Your Body, Jack Your Body by Steve Silk Hurley, and Love Can't Turn Around by Farley Jack Master Funk,
which is one of your
Del
tunes.
Pandy, yeah. We were so successful with that, then it was like, well, we've got to start a dedicated dance label. And FFRR was started. It was actually a little logo that sits on the London Records logo, and it stood for Full Frequency Range Recordings, because it's like an old fashioned kind of audio standard, a bit like stereo or mono or Dolby or something. So we liked the way that the badge looked, and so we pulled that badge off of the London logo and started FFRR Records. So,
well, we should probably play Love Can't Turn Around. And this was what? This was one of your own personal signings to London Records?
Yeah, yeah. So it was one of the first trips going to New York. I used to go to New York quite regularly, and and then a friend of mine sort of turned me on to house music, because all the DJs in New York were like kind of playing these house records from Chicago. And I got in touch with the guys up in Chicago from a label called DJ International, and I signed everything they had. It was like, you know, this was going to be the hot new thing. So it was like, whatever you've got in your drawer on your shelf, I'll sign that. And we put it together in an album called The House Sound of Chicago Volume 1 to kind of tell a story and introduce house music to the UK. And one of the tracks on the album was Love Can't Turn Around. And it featured this, you know, you're pretty eccentric as a vocalist, Becky, but this guy, Daryl Pandy, was a total diva. You know, huge man, gay, eccentric, with this most unbelievable voice. Very rarely you come across a voice like this. And I hadn't listened to this record for a long time until you asked me to do this podcast. You just hear his voice. It's a kind of breathy, like mad voice from the beginning of this track, and it still sounds special. So, yeah.
So here we go then. Love Can't Turn Around by Farley Jackman.
This is how we started. My dreams are broken hearted, 'cause I want you, baby. We'll never be the same, 'cause I'll play the same game. Then I want you, yes I do. My dreams are broken hearted, and I want you, baby.
They must have given you quite a big responsibility when you joined London Records, which is quite rare. I don't know what record labels were. My own personal experience with record labels is, you know, everyone shitting themselves about losing their job. If they sign the wrong thing and something goes to shit, you know, it doesn't look very good for an A&R. Your signings were insane. How did you feel any pressure? And if you didn't, is that what kind of made all these signings so easy for you? Because you were just going with what you felt like sounded good, over like thinking, shit, I better sign this because it's going to be, this is what's going to, you know,
It was a myriad of things. I mean, there was definitely pressure. Mm. It was a very male, dominated, like quite aggressive culture at London. We always felt we were the bastard child of the record business because we weren't a major, but we weren't considered to be an indie.
Yeah.
So we weren't like, Factory Records or XL. We were half and half. We were kind of helped by a major, but we didn't have all the benefits of a major. Like major labels back in the day, they'd take their risks, but the books would be balanced because they'd get a Bruce Springsteen album every year or a Michael Jackson album. We never got that. We had to scrap for everything we could possibly scrap for. So we were a bunch of scrappers. Mm-hmm. But there was pressure, and it was more a case of like just staying in profit rather than loss. So the guys I worked with, they didn't, I used to fight passionately about, we got to put music out because it's brilliant, and they're not all going to be hits, but it's brilliant because it's going to shape our label. So that was, as long as you loved it and it was brilliant, and there was still a hit along the way. The first record I ever put on FFR, I always tell the story, it was Baby Wants to Ride, which is Frankie Knuckles and Jamie Principle, which wasn't considered to be a hit. But the second one I put out was Push It by Salt and Pepper, which kept the lights on and paid the bills. And that was kind of the way we went. It was like, well, here's one for the here's a cool one and here's a hit one. And that's kind of the ratio. And people did lose their jobs at our label. And it is weird that some of the greatest records we ever put out were only considered to be great like 20 years after they got put out.
Yeah.
Because they became timeless classics, but they didn't actually pay the bills at the time. So, if people ask me today, what advice would you give as an A&R man? Just make sure you love it, because I've definitely signed things that I thought would pay the bills, that you didn't love, and then the minute no one else loves it, it's like, what am I doing with it? Like, you're stuck with it. So you've really got to sign stuff from the heart. Because if it doesn't work, you better make sure you really loved it. Because otherwise, like, what the hell are you doing?
Got to stand with your records.
And I think in time, I mean, we talked about Goldie. Goldie wasn't really a hit. One of my biggest ever frustrations as an A&R guy is that at the time, going through that process with him, it was really revered, but it didn't sell loads. We had to put Inner City Life out twice just to get it in the top 40, and I think even the second time it got to like 38. Over the course of time, the album's done quite well, but Saturn's Return, which is a whole different thing, was a complete nightmare. It didn't work out. And yet now people look back on that album as totally groundbreaking,
for sure,
with a 60 minute track called Mother.
Era-defining hours worth.
There is a
music.
Great book, if no one's ever read it, called Kill Your Friends, which John Niven wrote, which is basically loosely, it's kind of inspired by life.
His rage, right?
Goldie's rage in there, and that is about London Records.
It was the first, is it? Because it was the first
the
book I ever read in the music industry, and the only book I've ever read, and it fucking terrified me. Yeah. I thought, what am I doing here? It's racist, homophobic, sexist industry.
Exactly. Everything's obviously exaggerated, but there's a semblance of truth that runs through the narrative. Everything's just like magnified and like larger than life. And Ferdy'd never work for London, that's the other thing, because he's in the book.
I remember I was signed to Parlophone at the time I was reading it, and there was Miles from Parlophone, head of Parlophone, was mentioned, and there were certain people I was like, shit. Are these the purple people I'm working with? Interesting. I'd like to talk to you about you going to New York and finding all the kind of Chicago house records, because that's basically where house music was curated, right? And I think my kind of intrigue with it is that it started off a predominantly gay black scene. And there was all that stuff, correct me if I'm wrong, but like in Chicago where, white supremacists were going down to the baseball stadium and burning their disco records. How do you feel like, because I look around at the landscape of house music now, and I'm not sure whether it is as inclusive to gay black scene, to a gay black scene anymore. Whereas you've got the founders of like Robert Owens and Jamie Principle, who have kind of started off in that scene. How do you feel like it's kind of turned now, and do you feel like it's still as inclusive?
I think it's inclusive now. I think that the reason. Yeah, house music was always, it was like the bastard child of disco. They tried to bury disco. It was disco that they were burning the 12 inches in the baseball stadiums.
Yeah.
And it came back, whatever it was, 6-7 years later, through these underground producers in Chicago and to a certain extent in New York and Detroit. And, the kids that... any cool club scene I've ever been involved in at the very beginning, anything I've ever seen anywhere in the world... will always have a mixture of gay and straight. That's always like the hottest party, where the girls feel safest.
You're right.
You get the kind of flamboyance of the gay scene, and it's just edgy. And it's like, and I think that's happened in Paris, in the 1920s probably, and it still happens to this day in Berlin.
I suppose Glitterbox as well is a great example.
Yeah. And I think that's still the perfect mix for me. I mean, it was definitely there at the beginning in Ibiza. I think it's still inclusive.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'd certainly, playing in the best parties in LA and New York, now I live in America, is still where you get that kind of mix. So.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned Ibiza there. I remember Ibiza growing up.
Yeah.
And I remember it in a very Fred and Perry go large way.
Kevin and Perry.
Fred and Perry? I always do that. Kevin and Perry go large of way.
Well, that was your introduction to it, which is fair enough,
Yeah, but I suppose...
It had already become a cliche, you see, for someone to take the mickey out of it.
A little bit. Yeah. But I remember Trance, I think, in my early... I think that's my earliest musical memories as being trance music. And my mom had 9 a.m. till I come as her monophonic ringtone on her Nokia 3310.
Perfect.
For me, I remember that Ibiza, and especially with the trance movement, it felt like the records that I was listening to. I remember my brother giving me Alice DJ Better Off Alone when I was the single CD. And there were all those records floating about. And I remember really loving those tunes as a 6-year-old, I suppose I would have been. And it felt like a euphoric moment. When by the time I was getting to Ibiza, it was almost like I felt like there was something special that had been on the island but had kind of filtered out. I can't imagine what it was like going in the beginning of Ibiza. And for me, I've got some history of Ibiza. It started out as a kind of acid, hippie kind of magnetism place of the world, and then kind of became this dance sensation island for hedonists. When did you start going? Did you feel like there was something special there? Did you feel like it was a kind of bubble for dance music?
I first went in the late 80s on a holiday trip with Nicky Holloway and Paul Oakenfold, and It was very foreign. That was probably the best way of describing it. It was so different for us English guys going down to Ibiza. But there was a freedom there. Clubs opened later. Clubs went all night. And it was just like we were suddenly dancing with Spanish kids and like German kids. And So, but it was a bit all over the place in the late 80s. I didn't go on the famous trip that they all went on a few months later, when they all took ecstasy for the first time. And that was Nicky and Paul and Johnny Walker and Danny Rampling.
Wow, that must have been mental.
So that's always reported as the kind of transformative trip. And from that trip, those individuals all came back and started Acid House Clubs in London.
Right, interesting.
Which was Jum with Danny Rampling and Trip with Nicky Holloway that I worked with him on, and Spectrum for Paul Oakenfold. So, and then it was the rave scene in the UK and like that blowing up. And I started, I took a break from Ibiza for a year or two, and then I went back in 91. And DJ for Manumission, and then I've been every year since. So I think in the 90s it was, I think getting back to your point, whenever you go to Ibiza for the first time, if you find your place and your spot, then Ibiza can still be really, really
that
magical.
Thing for
you, and I think
yeah.
I think even in the 90s, for the real purists that were there in the 80s, they might be saying, well, it wasn't as good as the 80s, you know. But if you were going for the first time in the 90s or in the early 2000s, and you went to a Cream night on a Thursday at Amnesia, and you saw that, you dived into that kind of trance scene, which is where that really was coming from. Then, you know, those few years you go at a certain age of your life, and you go year after year with your mates, that changes, you know, it shapes your experience and shapes your life, and you remember those tunes forever, which is kind of full circle back to what the Ibiza Classic show is all about.
Yeah.
So I think the most... And Ibiza is constantly changing, you know, and it might not have looked like it changed in 5 years in the 90s if you were going continuously. But obviously, if you took a break and went back in the mid 2000s, it would probably seem like it changed a bit. And it always changes. And it has obviously become much more of a bigger business. It's but there's still, you can still find good stuff there. Will it ever be as kind of hippie, groundbreaking, making it up kind of as it was in the early 90s? No, definitely not. And it's important. The biggest challenges for Ibiza now is like, how do young kids afford it? Because it's got expensive.
And very VIP culture, right?
Very VIP. The table business is becoming more dominant. But you've still got success stories. You know, the People's Night in Ibiza this year was definitely the Salado Fisher Camel Fat Night at High on a Tuesday. That didn't really have that much table business. That was much more about kids on the dance floor. DC10 tries pretty hard and is generally pretty successful at keeping their thing more about the audience and less about the VIP, although they do have VIP things now.
Mm.
So you have to hunt around. But I think the biggest concern of all is if we don't have an audience there as DJs, then you're kind of completely fucked.
Yeah. I mean, because the reason why I started this podcast in the first place is because I've always been massively into my dance music.
Yeah.
And multiple different genres of dance music. And I think going raving now, and I suppose for the past 8 years, from 18 to 25, well, 17 to 25, I look at rave now and I have always wondered if I've missed out on something, which is why I started this podcast, to talk to people to find out whether the landscape of dance music has changed now. And the people that I've... spoken to already has said something similar. People will always look back on their golden age as their golden age.
Yeah.
They won't, you know, and they'll look less fondly on stuff that's happening right now, but stuff that's happening right now could be a golden age to somebody else. So with saying that, obviously with the Ibiza Classics show, that is, I look around that show night after night and I'm like dumbfounded. Like, it's mad how many people, and that ranges from like people my age to people in their 60s, 70s. Yeah. Like, there is a broad spectrum of people at that show.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to perpetuate that golden era of Ibiza and remind people why they went raving in the first place?
Well, yeah. I think it works. I mean, it obviously that wasn't, I think we, the first ever show I curated with Jules Buckley was simply that. It was meant to be a celebration of Ibiza. That's the way it started out, the one we did at the Proms. But obviously, once we saw the reaction in the room to the way everyone responded to it, and the fact that this music that basically people thought was a bit cheap, and was never going to be revered in the
hall of 100-piece orchestra,
the Hall of Fame, with you know, in the way rock and roll is. But played by an orchestra, it kind of added all this gravitas to it. So it kind of brought new life into these songs and these productions. And that was the magic. It was the magic of playing this music in a unique way, as opposed to just a DJ playing it. And then having this kind of, revival, you know, trip down memory lane, kind of nostalgia kind of trip, as someone famously called it. That mix in the room just made it. There was some secret sauce created,
and that's what
kind of made it addictive. And that's So I think now it's grown into this completely different beast with the whole production and the stuff on the screens and the likes of you joining us.
So
I don't. You know, there is some mad magic now.
It does. It does feel a bit mad for me because obviously I see people in the crowd. Just they've obviously come out for a night to take drugs and just go mad, and it's mad to watch. Like you're watching people like, you know, your mom and your uncle, and do you know what I mean? And they're going for it. I think for the listeners that don't know, I sing "Sing It Back" by Monoko on the last album, not the most recent one. Yeah. In fact, let me play it before I start talking about it. This is Monoko, Sing It Back.
I have succumbed to this passive sensation, peacefully falling away. I am the zombie, your wish will command me, laugh as I fall to my knees.
I remember Sing It Back growing up as a kid, and it was a few years later, but it was like my brother and sister who would make these compilation cassette tapes for my dad to put on in his car, and it was like, You Don't Know Me, Sing It Back, it was My. It was like tunes like that were, kind of coming through at the time. And what's mad to me now is that those songs are, it's almost cool again. It's not nostalgic anymore.
No. I think that's the other joy of it, is just celebrating the songwriting. You know, at the end of the day, that's the ultimate thing, isn't it? The fact that you can, a lot of great dance records were about production, and you don't necessarily cover them, but they're all,
you're right,
also reminding people that, there was some incredible songwriting and like lyrics, you know, and again, the same values that you would apply to, you know, a pop record or, you know, a Beatles record or whatever. That's what's going on with these songs, and that's why Sing It Back is timeless, and we've managed to, arrange it and make it in a way that it feels very contemporary. That whole idea of the transformation into the Giorgio Moroder kind of Donna Summer bit at the end, that comes from a bootleg that used to be played at DC10. That whole thing is based on a bootleg. Yeah, so
that mix
never came out. The way we do it is based on a bootleg, and the way we do, the way you sing it. So
great, that makes sense now.
Yeah, because that bit was never on the original.
No, and because it kind of takes it to a bit more of a darker place in the set. Yeah. I've always noticed that.
Yeah.
Interesting. I think
that's something that's so important today is keeping that kind of artistry alive, you know. And,
yes,
and,
for sure.
That's what I want to chase, you know. That's kind of shaped some of the choices for this podcast. But I think it's, that's what I worry about now in 2019, that where are the next Prodigies, and where are the next Basement Jacks, and where are the next Groove Armadas, and where are the next Chemical Brothers and the Underworlds, and, you know, there aren't enough disclosures, you know.
Yeah.
We want to keep more of that.
So interesting you say, because I think
there's a million DJs now. I mean, because software is so available, which is so creative. It's like, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, Ableton, Logic, everything's so cheap. I mean, there's billions of house tracks getting made, but there's not many songs getting written. That's the harder bit. So.
Well, what I've noticed, because my golden era of music was 2006, so it was kind of like all those top lines that were coming out. Yeah. I had Ministry of Sound annual 2006, which was just kind of Destination Unknown. It was Let Me Think About It. It was all of those kind of classics. They weren't necessarily house, but they were dance floor tunes. Yeah. And what I kind of got through talking to people in the industry is that A&Rs would send it out to one songwriter and you would get one song back and it would be the song that was out. Now you have, so for example, let's like, I use False Alarm as a reference, obviously, because I put it out through, well, it was put out through FFRR. That was written in a writing camp, which for me, writing camps seem quite clinical. I love doing them but because I love writing.
We're talking about Gecko, right?
Matoma, the False Alarm. But even Gecko, that was, you know, I know Gecko was Overdrive, well, Gecko in its form, was sent out to a few different people. And I think, you know, albeit it was a great success because me and M&EK just kind of went, fuck it, let's just write. It was, you know, we didn't think about it too much, which is where I think great songwriting happens, is when you don't overthink it. And nowadays I feel like the industry is kind of saturated in so many ideas and top lines and let's send it to this person and that person.
It's almost got too professional, you know. That
yes, there's less feel in it now. So, I mean,
It took Robbie Williams, actually, funny enough, to tell me one. I sat with him on a plane one day and he told me because he'd already, I mean, this has nothing to do with house music, but because he's written all his great music with Guy Chambers.
Yes.
When things were going wrong for him and he was living in LA, he told me his experience of first being involved in those kind of writing rooms, you know, where people just come through.
That's mad, isn't it?
And people just open their laptops and it's like, you know, and he found out that there was a specialist for, like, you know, there's someone that just did middle eights, or there's someone that just does the second, the bridge one, you know, chorus one, chorus two. And it was all so, like, you know, digital and kind of calculated that he was horrified. And I think what I'm trying to say with this is, you know, somehow we've got to, if we could join the dots of what people like you do and bring it closer to the producers, so it isn't like a factory farming.
For sure.
And a bit more from
you haven't got someone doing melodies in one room, someone doing lyrics in the other.
Because I think you're more likely to get a Finally, Kings of Tomorrow, or a, or a Nightlife, Kim English, or a
Ride
or
on
a
Time.
Sing It Back.
Sure.
If it's one person working a bit closer, understanding what it's more about, you know. So, yeah.
That's how I suppose that's how I've always liked to create, is being with the producer, writing from scratch.
Yeah.
You know, having this whole talking about everything and getting it out in the open. Yeah. I think, but I do, there is a bit of a pattern here. I think two of the things that I did want to ask you is, especially going back to our conversation ages ago, but definitely about how technology has changed. Because I've, I spoke to DJ Zinc, for example, and Andy C and Ronnie Size, and I was the podcast that I've had with them is very much how they would create tracks, and it sounds like fucking like wizardry.
Yeah.
You have to go through there's a thing called a DAT tape and and analog shit, and you have to record it and go back in and make sure everything's perfect, and if it isn't, you have to start again. You know, it sounds so difficult, whereas I sit in
the sometimes studio, when it's unperfect, it's brilliant.
Sounds better, and that's, you get happy accidents more so by doing it that way, whereas now, as you say, you've got Logic or Ableton and you can sit there, and if you make a mistake, you can tune it out and you can do this, that and the other. And do you think that has kind of, and again, this is the conversation with, you know, trying to find records from record shops and how difficult that was. Do you think that there's some sort of, I don't know whether prestige is the right word, but there is weight, there is less weight to being a DJ or a producer nowadays than there was back when?
I think it's interesting. It's I think it's a really interesting thing to study. I think I think you can still be a great DJ in 2019, but the criteria that gets you there is different to what it was maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. In a weird way, it's almost coming back to what it was 30 years ago. Because when I think now about someone like Peggy Goo, you know, she does make music. It's pretty cool. But what's actually really created the heat around her, apart from her Instagram account, is that she kind of really delivers when people go and see her. So she is actually a really good selector. She doesn't sound like anyone else. She can take you on a kind of different journey, and people are liking the experience and they're coming back for more. So that means she's actually a curator, and she's got a bit of a scene around her. And these are all things that would exactly the same, weirdly, for, you know, except we didn't have an Instagram account. But like, that's the way you made your name right at the beginning of this story. So that's quite nice. I think there's a DJ called Michael Beebe as well, who's running this label called Solid Grooves. And he's been around for a few years, but he's really broken through this year. And he runs hot parties that people go to, and he does make music that's pretty good. But he's quite a charismatic figure in the DJ booth. And he, that seems to be working for all what I would call old school reasons.
Right.
Whereas if we go back to the beginning of EDM, you know, and look at the breakthrough of David Guetta or Avicii or, you know, Swedish House Mafia, they really made their big step up in the studio. You know, they all made tunes. And the whole EDM era is really defined by the tunes they made. And obviously, the bit that goes after that is they did go out and, you know, David Guetta had a life as a DJ and was... got good at it before he ever made the Black Eyed Peas tune. And
Which tune did he make?
You know, I Got a Feeling.
Oh, did
you know,
he make that?
It was him and...
Oh, of course. It was around that era, wasn't it?
And that was Will I Am coming to Pasha one night and just seeing what was going on and going back to David's hotel room and coming up with that tune. So, but what I'm saying is the EDM era, those DJs were defined by their productions. Like that, as much as Peggy Goo, she's made a few good tunes and the promise is that she'll make better ones in the future. I don't think that's just that she's really happening because of being a curator and actually her DJ skills. And same for all the girls now, like Charlotte DeWitter and Amelie Lenz and Nina Kravitz. It's all been a whole female breakthrough, but it's already their abilities in the DJ booth, which is quite old school.
You know? It's the same with Molly Collins as well, I think. There's a few, you know, Harriet Jackson, there's a few females in the drum. Yeah. I mean, I'm drum and bass through and through, but, you know, there's a lot of...
Well, drum and bass is interesting because that was always about skills, I think. Like techno is actually about skills and not hits. So you don't really rise to the top of the techno scene necessarily by making great music. I mean, that's one way to get there, but it's actually, you have to really show up and deliver, and I think that's always been the way in the drum and bass scene.
I would disagree, only because there are some incredible songs.
Right.
And I think that's, drum and bass, I feel like, taught me how to put a top line on a song, on an instrumental, because you have people like Jenna G, you know, and with Shy FX did Feelings and Shake Your Body and stuff like that. I think what I've taken away from this kind of conversation is that you can be, you know, as you say, a million and one people can have Logic or Ableton. You know, you can do... Peggy's a really good example because it's more about the vibe of her.
Yeah.
You're almost going, it's almost like you're going to see an artist because of what she chooses to play, what she's wearing, how she's looking, because she is cool as fuck. But like the whole EDM vibe, and especially with drum and bass, I feel like it's so well produced that you can't be shit and be doing, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're working on Logic
or... you're definitely not going to get to the top of that tree. You can't, I mean, there's...
Right.
I mean, the EDM era was defined by the people, the best got to, you know, once you crossed into that super A-list, you know.
But it was such a good produced...
Calvin Harris spawned, you know, 100 people trying to sound like Calvin Harris, and we can't remember any of their names. You only really remember Calvin Harris. And same for Avicii, same for Swedish House Mafia, same for Guetta. So if you got into that top, you know, notch, you know, Skrillex to a certain extent as well, you know.
For sure.
It inspired a million people to kind of be like him, but there's only one Skrillex.
Well, dubstep was exploded. I remember when it came around in this, in the UK.
He was like a big thumbs down initially from the UK lot, you know.
I think he was great for the first 2 years. And when everybody else, I remember at school when we were all listening to Skrillex and then all the kind of goths and emos started listening to it. And all of a sudden it was like Grebo music and you couldn't listen to it anymore. And then it went to America and stuff. Okay, cool. Well, let's go on to the final track.
Yeah.
Because this tune actually shaped a lot for me and kind of put a flag plant in the ground for good music being made in you know, the 2010s. Yeah.
What I thought about this track is it just what I want to see. This is my kind of hope for the future, because I'm still involved in the record business. I want to find the next Disclosure, and I think these two, you know, those two, Howard and Guy, grew up like heavily influenced by a lot of the music I've been involved in my life. You know, house music, soul music, and there they are, two young brothers who were kind of curating their own world around them. And when they started, they pulled together this new generation. I mean, that first album is just mind blowing in terms of the talent that
it
features
was very
on
special,
it.
Yeah.
And it was like they'd found this whole new gang, like, as I say, new generation of singer songwriters, and they came up with something that from an artistry level was like a 10 out of 10. And there's not been, I can't think of one since, actually. But it did inspire, you know, I think people like you.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think that's, you know, when I look back and I think, where are the next, you know, Prodigies and Chemical Brothers coming from? Then we did get Disclosure, and hopefully they'll inspire, and we'll get another one.
Okay, so well, let's play Latch.
Yeah,
then,
there wouldn't be Sam Smith without
There would not be. You know. So without further ado, this is Latch by Disclosure. The first person that I've had in this podcast who has been slightly worried.
Yeah.
Everybody else has been like, oh, you know, music's just different now, and it's all changing, and it's all for the better, and you know, it's not that it was great back then and it's not as good now. I feel you on this. Yeah. I feel like we are getting to a point in music where
I've got a good thing to say.
Something, something has to change, because it needs to have a reboost.
Well, I think
right?
one of the scary things for me is that we've worked together now on Ibiza Classics for 4 or 5 years. We're at the end of a decade, you know, we're sitting here at the end of 2019. And I've got in my bag, I've got the Mix Mag of the decade, you know, the DJ magazine of the decade, and on tomorrow I'm doing the decade show with Annie Mack, where we're doing 4 hours together on Radio 1 to celebrate the decade. And there have been some good records from this decade, but there aren't many in the Ibiza Classics show. And that's the worrying thing, that I don't know how many, you know, we got Cola in there this year.
Yeah.
Which is a defining moment from 2018. But, you know, there's been a lot of sounds and moments and hype and some good stuff in the last 10 years. But most of those records that are timeless were written in the 90s or the first 10 years of the 2000s. So that's the bit I want to, you know, I think that's what we've got to look at for the next 10 years.
For sure. Well, I think it's too early to say if there's a timeless record happened, because it needs a bit more time. But I definitely feel
there's
like...
there's been some good records. I'm not getting wrong. But,
yeah, I know what you mean. There's not as many. And
but
that's very
interesting. I mean, we're doing this show, and we were putting together the track listing for it tomorrow, and it hasn't finally flushed out yet. But there's hundreds of B pluses,
right?
And moments, yeah. I can associate great memories with of the past 10 years. But when it got to the very, very top of the list,
yeah.
You know, what's the defining record of the last 10 years? I mean, as good as Cola was, you know, is that? That's not really. I don't know. I'm with the Camel Fat Boys, but
Well, so, sounds like it's my job to bring that to you then, Pete.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for being
been
here.
A pleasure.
It has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much. You've been great. Thank you. Pete Dog.
Thank you.